Good evening, everybody. My name is Kay Brewster, and I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. Deeply grateful to be here tonight. Did anyone notice a caution sign on Dave as he shared? My husband, Mac, used to say we used to be treated royally at the South Bay Roundup, and very generously and lovingly, but Mac always, and I'd say, oh, Dave just does such a good job here, and he said, do you see the caution sign on Dave? And that came to mind as you were pointing out your purity comment. Okay, so, well, the content of my story, I guess I should start out tonight about telling you the weight that I feel as we all have been liberated from mandate mask wearing. And just the energy in being able to look into your face and you into mine. It's just almost more than I can bear. Today I have been an emotional mess all day. But I'm so happy tonight to have an opportunity to share with you. I'm going to read something to start out with tonight because I read it this morning. It's not out of any of our approved literature. But what has happened to me over the day that I began my personal transformation, which was February 20th, 1975. I have studied out of many books our approved literature, but also desire deeper level of spiritual study. And so this was one of the books. And so I want to share it with you tonight. It was meaningful to you, to me this morning, and hopefully you'll hear something in it. It starts out, we nurture, let me see if this bookmark will get off of it. We nurture each other's special beauty by our loving actions. We all need to know we're truly appreciated. We may already believe that our life is purposeful, and we may already appreciate our unique talents. And the contribution we're making at a particular time may be evident to our friends or coworkers. Even so, our fears of not being lovable can still haunt us at times. These fears are easily put to rest when we help someone else feel special. All it takes is a moment of thoughtfulness, perhaps a simple decision to offer a smile or a loving touch, offering words of encouragement to friends who are feeling helpless, or simply taking time to listen when they need to talk. We'll assure them that they matter and that we care. Our higher power needs us to be emissaries of love in the world. That moved me this morning quite deeply, because I am here because of the love, loving beyond condition, the unselfishness of people in recovery when I was first brought here, who said, there's hope for you here, Kay. There's hope and possibility. And those two words are as dear to me today as when I was told them in the very beginning of my recovery. Before I go any further, I want to welcome members of Alcoholics Anonymous to our meeting. And to my Al-Anon brothers and sisters, you know how they are. So I have a little message for them. we already know that we talk at length, that we're over talkers, that we want to explain everything, that we're not short, to the point, always focused. We already know that. So we ask that you just remember that patience and tolerance is our code. Okay, now I want to do a little review on the speakers today. I'm honored to share the program with you, and I don't treat that lightly at all. Gretchen last night talked so eloquently regarding the damage that secret keeping does on us all, and how risky it is when something becomes a secret, and we try to live around that. So I bless her and her family for the message that she brought to our conference this weekend. The family meeting set me on, well, I just was a mess in the back of the room. My friend Lori said, I'll go get tissue. I didn't even have to ask. She saw me in an immediate emergency and ran for tissue. Because I saw our friend LaVon. I remember LaVon when I was new, and I didn't particularly care for her. Now, I'll tell you why. Because she isn't fair-skinned like me, and she would come into the meetings on her way home from Palm Springs. I had not been there yet, so I was jealous, of course. And she'd come into the meeting and kind of do a circle around when she'd come in with a pretty sundress, all tanned, and that beautiful white smile. And I thought, I just don't think I like this broad at all. But I've grown to love her over a very long time. She was the right and perfect person to teach my daughter how to swim. Don Babb, the father of her children, was very, very close to my husband, Mac, the absolute love of my life. And as the family shared today, Ray and his purely simple sale of the tools of recovery. How impressive. How really impressive, Ray. And then Cynthia gets up. Well, it was Heidi first. And of course, Heidi reminded me totally of my daughter, Stephanie. They know one another. They've known one another for a long time. We grew up families together in trouble and then in recovery. Cynthia got up and shared her story about being taken across the parking lot in chains to get on the bus to be taken to to jail. And that story, what I heard the very first time in the living room in my home, and Don was there to share that with Mac and I. And I cried. I cried. He said, I have never felt so powerless as I saw them take my daughter away, scared to death, believing that I knew what might happen to her. And so I got to hear that story firsthand. And today, as she shared it with everyone that was gathered at that meeting, I cried again. I cried out of the depth of gratitude that I feel these days, the weight of the transformation that belongs to each and every one of us here. A complete absolute. You know, in Al-Anon literature, we don't use the word absolute as much as we read in the big book and study out of the big book. But absolute gratitude is what I feel. At depth, I feel gratitude. And I realize that over a long period of time, I gave a lip service. How are you feeling today? Oh, I'm deeply grateful. Deeply grateful. I was not lying, but there was certainly an element of lip service. Today, I know I have experienced absolute, at-depth gratitude. And the content of that is almost too much for me to carry. My life has been totally blessed, totally undeserved. So that was, let's see, who else do I want to talk about here? I want to talk about Emmalinda. Like Emmalinda, I fell in love with a great dancer. And for those of you in the room that remember the convention, Southern California Convention, that Mac chaired, and we had a sax player, and it was all so fun, and I just kept edging to the edge of my seat, and pretty soon he just grabbed my hand. We went up on stage and we danced. One of the things that pleased me so much about Mac, he was born to be full of joy. He was an alcoholic, and he earned his way into being legitimately called an alcoholic. He gained things, he lost things, he hurt himself, he hurt other people. But at the bottom of all of that was a wealth of joy. And Mac didn't want to miss a thing. And AA told him, you will not have to miss a thing as long as you stay sober. And in Al-Anon, they talked about back then, and we talk about it these days as well, that if we let our God precede us in every action that we take, every day, we are in good spiritual stead. And so I believed them. So that was Emma Linda's, that's where I identified. And then today at the luncheon, Cheyenne. Well, if you weren't touched by that beautiful young woman, then go outside and then come in again. Because to have the kind of awareness and honesty that we heard today from that young woman was breathtakingly inspiring. That she had the focus to see her way beyond from the center of her family, where there was a great deal of dysfunction. She, unlike me, had said nothing rude about her family today. She just shared her focus, the blessing of focus. I was just totally impressed. And so I thank the committee. I thank Susie for all the work that's gone into this weekend, and I'm so glad to be here. All right, I thank my friend, Lori, sitting beside me. When I left Los Angeles and went to the Central Coast, because that's where my higher power and Mac Brewster needed to have me be. Because we drove up there many, many times. And Mac said, if I only had more money, baby, I'd buy you a home in Cambria. That's where I'd buy you a home, in the pines overlooking the ocean. And we'd drive up and down and all around the roads. And just before he got sick, we went up there and he said, if you want to sell the house after I'm in heaven, that's great. But he said, I need to know that you'll go to the Central Coast and live, because I need to know where I can find you and who that creep is that's sitting in a rocking chair in front of your house, the guy that's sitting in the rocking chair. And I said, there won't be any guy. And there has not been any guy. You know, those of us in this room that have been privileged to be blessed with the greatest love of your life know exactly what I'm talking about. There isn't another person out here that I need to cuddle up to. I have been overpaid and blessed in that department. So now I'm free to love all the men in my life. I want to thank my Covina family. My Covina family has been with me for 40 years. 40 years. And they were with me every step of the way. Most of the people in this room know me better than I might know myself at any given moment. You were all the right and perfect people to help me, give me a hand up, and help me realize that the dreams that I felt robbed of as a kid could indeed come true. I thank my Central Coast family, those of you that are here from the Central Coast. I left LA and went up there and was told by my sponsor, you keep your mouth shut when you go up there. Truthfully, Kay, the people that you're going to be going to meetings with really don't care how long you've been around. They don't care about your style, how you got it, what you had to get rid of. Why don't you just try attending the meetings the way they're laid out, without complaint, without judgment? And I thought, I don't know why she's talking to me like I'm 10 years old. I've been around for a long time. Well, she knew me and knows me very, very well. And so I followed her instruction, and I went up there and attended their meetings as they were laid out. Very different from Los Angeles. And she was right. I had reason for complaint. However, she told me that I was to keep that to myself. And as God would have it, they asked me after a while to share at a day event up there. And because I was new in the area, they asked me to speak. And as God would have it, on that very day, she said, you can unleash what you want them to know after you have attended their meetings the way they're laid out for 1 year. So you don't tell them, how long you've been in recovery. You share, period, share. You know nothing. And I believed her at that time. I can't imagine why I did, but I did. And I went up there. So here I was at this event, and it was the very day that I had completed my year. So I kind of took advantage of that a little bit. And I went up there and introduced myself and said I was so happy to be at their event and to be asked to share. And I said, so now, I minded my sponsor, I kept my mouth shut for 1 year. Hold on to your seats, because today the year's completed. I'm gonna really tell you how it is. And I did. And they just pulled a chair back from the table, wrote my name right on it, and invited me to sit down and continue to come to meetings there and be part of their recovery community. And I'm honored to be up there now. They're all, as well, all the right and perfect people are surrounding me there. And another blessing is when Mac went to heaven, and he went for a coffee position. Those of you in AA and not know how Mac always said, I was always told, you go and you get a coffee position. That's what you do to make yourself feel purposeful and serve the recovery community. And so when Mac went to heaven, no coffee job available. And so a loving God said, however, I do need help in hanging the moon and the stars at night. And so my little quirky way of thinking about my husband and where he is and what he is doing, he helps hang the moon and the stars. So when you all are out at night, and you're able to be in a place where the sky is very, very dark. And where I live, that is what I get every night, because it's not the big bright lights of the city. I've been there, done that. And I sit quietly now under a dark sky and enjoy the moon and the stars at night. Mac did that so well that God promoted him to be in charge of rainbows now. So he told me, he said, I'm doing a good job, and I want you to know about it. All right, so I think I got through everything except what happened to me. I'm the oldest of three children. I have two younger brothers. I wasn't born a troublemaker, but I was a risk taker. I've always been a risk taker. And that can serve you well for a short period of time. And then then you just find yourself out of gas, out of ideas, and alone. And I didn't miss any step along the way. I was raised in an Irish Catholic family, and that should be a plus. And for most people, it is. But I got to come to recovery to realize how everyone has a right to their religious perspective, and how valuable or not that it is to them. And I felt outside. I was told by my mother, you would rather lay on the couch, eat pastry, and read than make your bed. The bed needs to be made, get in there. And then she would stand by me and and redo it after I had done it, because the corners weren't correct. You know, the quilting on the top wasn't lined up with the edge of the bed. Now, I used to talk at length about my mother's and my situation, but tonight I want to change it up a little bit. I want to honor my mother. I want to honor my mother. And the programs of AA and Al-Anon, please take credit for what I'm going to tell you. I didn't ever get along with my mom. My mother wasn't real comfortable with me either. And I used to think I need to recalibrate this and find out the reasoning why that all went on. And not anymore. Not anymore. I drove around with my mom in the trunk of my car, and then she graduated to the garage after her passing. And for 10 years. And why did I drive her around and keep her in the garage for so long? Was because my higher power said, you say you have forgiven your mother, Kay, but in truth, have you forgiven your mother, Kay? And when questions like that for me roll around a time or two, then my higher power is saying, please hear me. Please pay attention. And so I did. I finally, through lots of reams of writing about my mother and my justified reasoning behind why she didn't respect me and I didn't like her, was just a penny-ante complaint. I needed to attend enough meetings to understand that everyone is a child of God. Doesn't make any difference. I'm not in the assessing or critiquing business. But because I was a kid that longed for connection, I wanted to talk about things. I wanted to ask questions about things. And my mother said, you do what you're told, what I tell you to do. And I was taught not to feel. I wanted to talk about things. And she'd send me to my bedroom, a sick kid sent to her bedroom with the call down the hall that says, and when you're ready to talk about what you are doing and how crazy you are, then you come out and we'll have a talk. And so a sick kid sitting in a room alone, that was me. And I would come out to the kitchen periodically and want to talk with her. And she'd say, I'm busy now. I'm busy now. So legitimately, I felt not heard. And legitimately, I realized that I would take the lesson of not being heard, feeling robbed of my dreams. I think Cheyenne spoke of that earlier today. I identified with that totally. I had dreams and aspirations, but that all turned dark. It all turned dark after a while. And then I'd come out and long to have my mom talk to me. In all this reading that she used to criticize me for, I used to see pictures in the books of a mother and a little girl holding hands, both of them dressed in a same color coat, double-breasted. And the mama maybe had a hat on and some gloves. And they both had a little purse. And I wanted to breathe life into that picture, out of that book. And there's no way that it was going to happen in my home. I longed for my mom to sit with me and talk with me. Was she wrong because she was unable to do that? Heavens no. Heavens no. Was I wrong because I longed for something that I was not getting? No. There's no right or wrong about that. It is the illness that our families, how deeply affected the illness is in our families. And the dysfunction was paramount in mine. I was raised in an upper middle class home, given a fabulous education for which I had no appreciation at the time. And we all had our roles in the house. And no touching, no hugging, it was strictly business. And when I felt that I had been born into a corporation, pretty much that's what we had. I can remember my mother saying one time to me, "So you don't feel that you're loved?" And I said, "That's right, I don't." And she said, "Well, we gave you everything, and we asked little of you, and if you would have done just a little, then maybe you would have felt loved, because in this family we produce. We produce in this family." That was the key comment. If you'll feel loved, if you get the grades, if you produce for the family, and you stand tall behind the family name. Well, the lessons that I learned then, I took into adulthood. So I knew nothing at all, really, about empathy, compassion, loving, inclusiveness, care, love. I didn't know anything about that. And I was a very successful retailer. I went into the career that my dad, he was a retailer, and I thought that I would get some attention from my dad. No, that wasn't available either, because my dad had already written the script that he wanted his two sons to follow him in his chosen career. And I was a woman, and this was quite a while ago, a long time ago actually now. And so women in business, we were still fighting our way up to the glass ceiling. We were still climbing. And so my dad was not really interested in the fact that I liked the career and that I was willing to learn from him. I can remember doing my homework in his office and then running out onto the floor. And I always felt that my timing was off and that I was somewhat of a pest. But the core of that was my longing to belong somewhere. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about how I sought companionship and sought answers for myself in being married. In this little valley town where I lived, I went to the city college. I did not go to the city college to do anything regarding getting smarter. I went there to find my husband, find somebody that I thought I could marry that would have enough money to provide lifestyle that I had grown quite accustomed to, and I was sure that I could find him there. And I found him in Spanish class, and he was tall and a good-looking guy, and we'd be tested, and he'd always finish his test and be out of there and down to the campus center and out of my view. I couldn't afford that. And so I got the best grades in a language class that I ever had in my whole life, because I had already made an investment in this guy. I hadn't even introduced myself. I hadn't even begun to flirt, but I had made the necessary investment, and I was bound to get down there and protect it. We got married. We moved to Santa Monica. He went to Santa Monica City College, and I went to work in Westwood Village, and I loved it there. I loved it there long before Bullock's was built there, and the village was the village back then, and it was tremendous. And all of a sudden, I got afraid. I felt incomplete. I felt that I had to do something, take some action. So my idea was that it was time for us to start our family. Did I take a moment and share this important information with my husband? No. No, I just did what I had to do to get pregnant, with his help, of course. And then all of a sudden we had this little baby. I loved the attention. I loved the attention. It was part of my longing, part of being seen and heard and inquired with during my pregnancy. Showers were wonderful. Little baby came, and I was terrified. I knew deep down that I was ill-equipped to take care of this precious soul. And this baby was perfect in every way, in every way. And we had old play pens back then, and I can remember putting her in it, and then I'd go across the room and sit and watch her. I mean, I can't tell you how long I was around here. It had to be probably probably 25, 30 years in recovery before I finally surrendered to the fact that my illness was not a soul sickness, however I called it that for a while. My illness was mental illness. And there was such shame involved in that for me to own that and call myself out in that way that I deny that there was any mental illness at all. But even with this little baby, as I sat there and watched her move around that playpen all by herself, and I couldn't make myself move. I couldn't make myself nurture her. And so my solution was to have another baby to keep her company. That was the best I could do back then. And God delivered another perfect baby to me. My husband now, by this time, had gone to work, so he was unavailable. And at nights, I would think about all the fun that he had to be having wherever he was. I was not having fun. And the things that I share with you tonight, I'm not proud of. But I'll tell you the miracle, and I am a miracle as well with each and every one of you. The miracle is that I know and accept responsibility for my behavior, and I am personally free today from the shame, guilt, fear that surrounded all that inadequacy, not being able to take care of my children, not feeling the nurturing love that a mother and a dad feel for their children. That was pretty much all I wanted to say about the first marriage. We moved around. Oh no, I need to tell you this. We moved around, changing, and I felt, in looking back on it, like I was the alcoholic, like a new area of living. We'll take care of things. We'll make it different. No difference. No, it did not. You take your illness with you. I wasn't told that until I came into meetings, and I thought, oh, I don't believe that. I believe that you can get better on the spot. Well, of course, and I ended up in Al-Anon asking for help and pleading with you to not deny me that and not set me aside or throw me away. So when we moved into Downey, we lived in Downey, California, and my husband was working hard and not at home all that much. And there was a gentleman that was single that lived next door, and I thought that that he might understand. So I would climb the fence from my yard to his yard. And I set up counseling appointments, and I'm not proud of that today, but it did bring me to a point in my life where I was almost beat to death. This guy was a schizoid personality. He, like Dave, were enamored with guns, and he just beat me unmercifully. And he was an alcoholic. I still can't remember the liquor that he drank, but it's still in my mind's eye. It's the one that came in the blue bag, the purple bag, whatever that was. Yeah. And he just went berserk on that. And my children, when I wasn't able to go home, and my family was in an uproar because they could not find me. My husband didn't know, no one knew where I was, and I was right where I had always been, at the next door neighbors. And he beat me, to an inch within my life, and my children hid in the closet. Now, that, out of an inventory written, that had to come out, and I had to see that it was my hand writing that, and that it was going to be my voice in sharing it in the fifth step. And there was a great deal of guilt and remorse, and why did it happen to me? Well, it was necessary, I know today, for it to happen to me. I was taken from the little hospital in Downey. My stepsister eventually found me from conversations that she put together that led the authorities to the house next door. And they rushed me to Downey Hospital. They didn't have the equipment there to save my life, and I went on to the old county hospital off of the 10, heading into LA. And I came to in an old style oxygen tent with all the condensation running down. And at the foot of my bed, it was not an illusion, they were all there, were my family, my mother, my dad, my brothers. They had married their wives. They were all there, at the foot of my bed, looking at me. And I so wanted to say to them, say something. I wanted to know that they were real, that I wasn't having just a, you know, an out-of-body experience. And they looked scared and sad. The energy that I felt that day inside that tent was, we feel so sorry for you. We feel so sorry for you. And nobody had forced me on this journey. This was a journey I took each day, thinking that I was totally in charge of things. And when I was brought to Al-Anon, I wanted to talk at length about, what in the world does this control thing mean? What does this control thing mean? Explain that to me again. I controlled my destiny in ways of my own that were never, ever going to bring me any sustenance in any way, spiritually or any other way. And so I got out of that hospital and stayed in Los Angeles. My mother wanted me to go and live with her. And I said no, stayed in LA and moved into an apartment house on somebody else's money. And it was in this house that I was going to meet my second husband. And the only thing that I'll say about this guy is that he was Blackfoot Indian and something else. I was so impressed with Blackfoot Indian that I never ever really inquired much more than that. He had that beautiful skin and he was a beautiful man. And we have a daughter that is evidence of that today. And I wish him well wherever he is. I feel some compassion and empathy for him because he has missed out on some of the most glorious days of Stephanie's and my recovery. The birth of her son, my grandson, and the successful young man he is today. Stephanie's continuing sobriety. I revisit my commitment every day on what is important for me to do to feed my spiritual fitness. These are huge blessings. And this guy had other things to do. So I've learned to wish him well. But we had some fun. We went to Las Vegas and we did a lot of fun things and sat in the sun and I ruined my skin but I've even forgiven him for that. Because I was on the chase. I was on the chase and I was on the take. I needed somebody to come in close and help me without me asking for help. And then to get close to me, you were faced with that false sense of self, that boldness that I over being not in touch with any of my feelings because I had been trained not to. I developed boldness. And I, like I said earlier, I was a risk taker. So I'd walk into a place like I owned it. And I was so successful in behavior like that that nobody ever questioned me. I mean, I've been in the staff weight room back there in more hotels in Los Angeles than I can remember. Just because I parked the car, walked in, walked through a room, walked into the wait staff. Thank you, honey. Walked into the wait staff and no one questioned me. It was, you know, it's the gait that you walk in with. It's how you hold your shoulders. It's the tilt of the head, and I learned to play that to the fullest. On the inside, terrified, driven by fear every moment of every day. but I pulled it off because it was part of my survival techniques. Okay, and then of course the third love of my life, when I was looking for someone else to complete me and love me and fill me, was Mac B. It was quite a journey to get into recovery. I want to give word today to my friend Judy. Judy was the gal that when I felt I was losing my mind and ways of my own were not working at all, I thought I'll go to a general education, a little summer program, and learn to paint plaster of Paris. I was smoking 3 packs of cigarettes a day, and I felt that if I went and learned to paint plaster of Paris, it would help me focus. And so I went. Now, I believe today, totally, that a loving God moves me and moves you to the place where you need to be, where you can serve him best. And this was part of my journey to surrender to a power greater than myself. I went to the school, only about 3 corridors in it, and I was lost. And another woman appeared, and I went to ask her a question, and she said, well, I'm looking for that room too. I can't find it. Well, this woman became my dearest friend. She became the angel that a loving higher power sent to bring me to recovery. And that day, she said, would you like to go to lunch? I hadn't treated myself very kindly for a long, long time. And I said, yes. And we went to a little bar down next to the Greyhound bus station in West Covina. And we walked in. We walked in and we walked right by the bar. She knew absolutely where she was headed. And we went to the back to a booth. It was dark and cool back there. And she proceeded to tell me her life story. And legitimately, it was very sad. It was very sad. She cried, I cried. She was drinking, I was drinking Coke. And so then she said, and what about you? And that became a terrifying question that was hard for me to answer. I didn't have enough information to gauge what direction I needed to go in to not let her down and get what I thought I needed from her. I mean, this is all the calibration that goes on up here in my head, that's assessing everything. And I told her a story, and I was so proud of myself that day because I made her cry, and I even cried. And most of it was not the truth. And so I kind of labeled myself as a good storyteller as well as I was moving along. This girl was, I didn't see her after we broke up after that lunch, and for a while. And then one night, I ran to the grocery store. I didn't go out in the daytime because I didn't want to see myself and I didn't want to see any of you. I was terrified. That's where the fear, I was strangled by the fear. It just moved up and just held me right here. And I would run out. Now I weighed about 87 pounds at this time. My hair, I could sit on it, not washed most of the time. I didn't change my clothes often. I knew nothing at all about self-care. I had given up. None of my ways worked. I could not get what I believed I wanted. And as a result of that, why take care of myself? I ran into Judy at the grocery store, dark, it was nighttime, and I saw her and she just went all white. I could see the mouth moving. I couldn't hear what she was saying. I got so frightened I ran away from her and ran home. What Judy had said was, Kay, I'm going to a place now and I think it might help you. And I'll come by your house and get you. And I didn't hear that, but one day, knock, knock on my door, I opened the door and there she stood. And I just want to tell you a little bit about how I had ceased taking care of my home as well. I had laundry on the couch, on the floor, on the table, everywhere in the house. Some of it folded, the majority of it just thrown there. In the kitchen, I had cooked meals, and he had not come home. I couldn't get him to come home, but I left the evidence that I had done my part. If you need evidence, I've done my part. I would just move the cooked meal to the center of the table and then cook another one up the next night. So we had levels of, you know, of dishes to the edge of the table. And he would come in, and I would jump in bed, pretend to be asleep. I didn't know whether I was coming or going. And so Judy came in, and she said, well, let me help you clean up. And then, of course, I was strangled by the guilt and shame of me not taking care of business. I put on the only pantsuit I had that would closely fit how very rail thin I was, and she took me to the 502 Club in Covina. And she said, you're gonna come with me, and we're gonna go in here. And I said, oh, the place looks dirty. A portion of the curtain was hanging off the rod. I mean, it was not a detailed place. And she said, just look past all that. Follow me. She got out of the car. Now she got really bossy. And so I followed her in there and, of course, opened the door. And you couldn't see beyond the second person in there because smoke was so thick. Everybody, when I was brought to recovery, was smoking. Everybody, including me. And they had a pool table in there, and I was just looking around for anything that I could hang my hat on, that I where I could do something to get myself out of there. And I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. I thought everybody was really dull and boring. I've heard that spoke of this weekend as well. They were all seemingly about my age tonight, all seniors. And a girlfriend said one time, years later, when she was sharing her story, she said, you know, I came in thinking, where do the hip, slick, and cool kids go? I mean, come on, send me to those meetings. I want to be the still hip. Show me where the still hip meetings are. And that's what I thought, too. And yet these people opened their hearts, minds, took my hand, allowed me to stand inside or outside the prayer circle, not holding their hands whenever I felt that I wanted to be a showboater. And I didn't get kicked out. They didn't ask me to leave. In fact, they invited me to come back. So now I want to tell you how I met Mac B. I finally got a sponsor. And I ran into a meeting one night, and my friend Carol and I, we were both smokers back then, and we used cigarette holders. And I smoked with a holder as well. And when the luncheon speaker was talking about matchy matchy, my head immediately went. I had a set of brights and a set of pastel cigarette holders. And as I would put an outfit together, I'd make sure that I had the matchy matchy cigarette holder. Because I really kind of thought that you were like me. I was always most interested in me. And I thought that you'd be looking and you'd be checking that out. It never dawned on me that you really didn't care one way or the other, whether I was matchy matchy or not. But it mattered to me. And this gal, I sat down to her one night. I was late to the meeting, something that I was taught early. You arrive on time, you start your meetings on time, and you stay all the way. There's no getting up, walking around. This is how we do it here. And I thought, oh. And I sat down, and this woman next to me said, hi, Kay, how are you? And I said, I'm just fine, thank you. And that no longer sooner left my lips than I started to do the very thing that I had judged people up to that point in meetings that I was going to. And that was, God, you guys, come on, you got to be smarter than allowing yourself to lose emotional control. No tears around here. You buck up. You lift that chin. You keep those tears inside, even if you feel them. This is what you do, because the minute that you show that, I had seen the meetings just get up and swarm that person. I thought, oh, that'll never happen to me. Well, it did happen to me. It happened that night as I cried uncontrollably. Letting go of years of packing down lies and desire and want and aren't I good enough? All of that was just came open that night. So my sponsor, so I asked that woman to be my sponsor. And it was Marianne T. And Marianne said, you're going to an open AA meeting once a week. And I said, well, I'm not a member. She said, I'm perfectly aware of what you are and you aren't. I mean, I was fighting for my very life here, and she just seemed to overrule everything. So I went to this open AA meeting, and in the back walked Mac. And he glad-handed all across the back of the room, and then hit the center aisle. He was always a center aisle kind of guy, and I was immediately smitten. I thought, oh, this is, I need to pay some attention here. So unfortunately, or fortunately for me, I leaned over to my sponsor, my new sponsor, and I said, who is that guy? And she said, you've asked the wrong question. You ought to be saying, who is the very attractive blonde that is following him up the aisle? And I spent the rest of that meeting thinking, why would she point that out? I couldn't begin to imagine why it was that was important for me to hear. Well, soon I did my very best flirting the next few times I saw Mac. And I was on my way up to San Luis Obispo to work for my to work at the Madonna Inn, which I did. And that is a whole other story in itself, what happened up there. But I wasn't going to meetings up there. That is what is important for you to know. I was changing territory, so I was going to get out from under the pressure, the things that forced me to do what I did. Was I willing to change anything or stand responsible for my behavior? No. No, I knew now I had was starting to hear about this victimization thing and volunteering for that. Oh, no, no. I thought, I am a victim. I was a victim from the day I was born. And so I held on to that, and I didn't see the necessity for me to change anything. So Mac followed me up there and in telephone conversation, and he'd buy me airplane tickets for Stephanie and me, and he would fly us back to LA. And then Steph would go be taken care of by other people, and her mom would have the necessary affairs. And I wish that that part of my story wasn't real, but it was real. I set her aside, and I did what self demanded. And I'm not proud of that either, but I am so spiritually free these days that I can say, I've been there, done that, and a higher power has moved me beyond that. It is now the experience it is for me to share. And Stephanie and I have, we've had our ups and downs. I'm not embarrassed nor feel any shame at all to talk about what a fearful, bossy mother I was. I looked at her birth because eventually the state of California, going back to when I was beat and all, labeled me an unfit mother. And the state took those little girls away from me. So when I met Stephanie's dad, I thought, oh great, it's another chance to have another child. Had I grown any? No. Had I learned anything? No. Did God deny me another beautiful, perfect child of his? No. And it was a long time for me to get my mind around how he could have been so generous to a woman that was so ill-equipped. But now I think how lucky I was that I can share with you, we are never beyond help. We are never, ever ill-equipped to the point where you are without hope and possibility. No matter what your outside circumstance is, come to meetings, show up. You heard it all day today. You'll hear it tomorrow, the same. We are worth recovery. I have never been denied the absolute right and perfect people to give me a hand up. I've learned in recovery that I don't have the answers. I have never had the answers. I get to recover. I have had a total second chance at life, and it has nothing to do with any of you. It has everything to do with me. Can I lean in? Can I answer the questions, the hard questions? I'm just on the other side of a very big deal in my recovery. I heard a few of the ooh when you realize how long I'd been in recovery. I've always been blessed with sponsorship. Wonderful, wonderful, meaningful, inspirational sponsorship, guidance, and help. And I've always been deeply appreciative of everything that, every modeled behavior, every moment of their time, every moment of their interest, love, and care for me. I never ever felt denied or set aside. The very thing I longed for was I had found a place where possibly I could find where I fit. And so, there's no pamphlets on sponsorship for a long timer, but I had a lot of questions, and I spoke to Betty Ann many, many times. Thanks, sweetheart. Many, many times about sponsorship and how it was being expressed and how we were seeing it in our meetings and what your shares were, how she was hearing the shares, how I was hearing the shares. And we were both very interested in sponsorship. And I was being guided, and I had been loved and cared for her and her family for a long, long time. And there is no pamphlet that is written on when a long-timer like me has a sponsorship crisis. And what ended up happening was I was only a thought away from an old idea. Betty Ann's family, Bob, her husband, there were medical concerns. She legitimately had a lot on her plate. I took that and used that as an excuse why I was not feeling sponsored. My part in that was that I justified out pulling away and beginning, Gretchen, it may or may not be in the room, and it became a deadly secret for me. I wasn't talking about it either. And this was going on the last 2 or 3 years. I was living this secret, calling Betty Ann, my sponsor, pulled out away from her, not connecting with her. And there was no place that I could go and read about what do you do in a case like this. And finally, I got up one morning and the burden was too great for me to carry. And I called another member, a woman that I'd been going to meetings with for a long time, off and on. And first thing out of my mouth was, help me, I'm in trouble. I'm in trouble. And that surrender that day at that time did not seem difficult for me. I was prepared and ready, and it was in God's timing that I bring this to the table. She gave me several writing assignments. I did them, and I knew that would probably have an opportunity, like not necessarily from the front of the room, but where both women were in the same room with me. And that's what I have tonight. I'm looking at my new sponsor, and I am in deepest gratitude for the years, Betty Ann, that and the attention and love you gave me. So I don't know, do you think maybe there's a piece of literature that I might write? For the long timers. The love of my life, the very greatest love story that I was privileged to live with Mac Brewster, came to an end in 2012. And and I told him on his deathbed, I said, I'm going to come undone. I won't know how to do anything without you. And he said to me, I suggest you continue to go to meetings. And he said, I'll be watching you from heaven. So don't think that you can pull in the wool over my eyes, right? And And I remember seeing Cynthia's dad. Max said, call Don. Call Don, I want to see Don immediately. And I called Don and said, Mac needs you. Mac wasn't asking for me, his wife. He was asking for an AA brother. And Don answered that call, of course. And as I saw Don walking down the hospital corridor toward me, I began to cry. And he embraced me and said, hold on. Hold on. I'll go in. And as he walked into the door, I heard Mac say, oh, Don, I don't want to die. I don't want to die. And I have no idea, nor should I even ask, what Don's response was. But an AA brother reached out on his deathbed, and an AA brother answered. So if I feel weepy about the family meeting today, that's just a little bit of the history that I share. Don would come in and he'd say, orange slices. You always have orange slices. As a kid, orange slices were the very best. It was triggering to him. Lemon drops was another one. The old fashioned, he'd say, oh God, I'm always so glad to come over here and pick up Mac, and they were going wherever they were going. He'd say, because you always have the best candy out. I said, and no kids. You know, a candy bowl doesn't last if you got kids. But I mean, this is the rich history that was laying in wait for somebody like me to be brought to a program of recovery where I get to do things. I get to recover. I get to serve the fellowship. I get to go to meetings. I get to say yes every time I'm asked to do something. I've been blessed with good health, and I'm ready to commit to keep that going so that I'm in good physical health, so that I'll never have to, because of a health concern, not say yes to an Al-Anon request. I'm going to be mother of the bride. I'm going to be mother of the bride, and if I'd had my way, my ways had worked for me, I would be dead and gone and long gone. And what's important to me today, Stephanie and I have talked about this, it is living the behavior that honors Mac Brewster's legacy, that honors her dad and my husband's legacy. And periodically I'm told by my about-to-be new son-in-law that at the meetings that he attends, that every once in a while somebody will refer to Mac. And this is what legacy is all about. A San Pedro in the weeds drunk that barricaded himself in a bedroom and couldn't get out. And to the point where we now are talking about his legacy. This is within reach and spiritually intended for us all. For us all. And all we have to do is lean in, continue to do what is right for us, come out the other side giving the very best of ourselves, and stop the self-critiquing. Remember that we always have choice, that the presence of a loving God is ours every moment of every day. And then go to meetings to be reminded of that. The early morning meeting, I've become a regular at the early morning meeting. And these are women in Alcoholics Anonymous, double winners, have so much to share from their program. And then there's also many Al-Anon members that are in this meeting as well. And you know, in Al-Anon, I was never told, a meeting every day. In AA, you're told that from the gate. Your life depends upon it. Thank you, honey. Oh, really? I'm so happy that she spelled done in caps. So back to the mother of the bride. So I didn't think I was going to live long enough to see our daughter find the love of her life. And I'm just going to tell this, even though I have not asked Stephanie and Warren's permission to tell it, but because it is so deeply beautiful and sensitive to me. And it shows the power of God in each of our lives. Stephanie and Warren knew one another when they were teenage, young people. And they were drinking, doing drugs, and doing what they do. 32 years ago, that's what existed for the two of them. And Warren married and fathered a beautiful family. I have four new great-grandchildren. They're beautiful. They're going to, I can't wait to meet them. So all the things that I longed for, God is providing for me. The inclusiveness of family, the belonging. Somebody asked me, well, what does Warren think about children? Are they going to be included in the wedding? And I said, strange you should ask. He says, all the kids are there. They can throw rose petals wherever they want to. And, you know, and Stephanie's just standing back nodding. God is taking care of all the things. He's bringing making our dreams come true. So I have backed out of my daughter's business. She is being treated to a wonderful, beautiful new life as Mrs. Northwood. And I am thrilled about it. 32 years later, Warren calls and says, hi, well, how are you doing? And she says, not very good. Well, do you want to talk about it? Well, yeah. And born out of that came an engagement, beautiful engagement party. She wears a beautiful ring on her finger as evidence of Warren's love for her and hers for him. And there's going to be a wedding in May. And I am thrilled about being the mother of the bride, minding my own business, being invited in. There's nothing that's more spiritual and more gratifying and beautiful than not running in and taking control, but being invited in. So I've learned to not make trouble for myself. And I've been given all the right and perfect people to support that for me. I'm so grateful that I was asked to come. I have no idea. I just prayed before this meeting and said, I'm opening my mouth, and what is going to fall out is what is supposed to fall out. I don't want to leave without saying, my name is Kay Brewster. I've learned to live one day at a time, and I am sponsored and gratefully so. Thank you very much.